This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Encore Boston Harbor Casino in Everett opens on Sunday. Members of the media are there today for a walkthrough. Among them is WBUR Bostonomics reporter Callum Borchers, who joins us now from the casino. Hello, Callum.
Hi there, Tiziana. Yeah, I haven't won anything yet, so I'm still here. I haven't quit the day job yet. Still here reporting.
Well, do not come home until you're up. Let's just be clear. We should note, Callum, that this is a really controlled tour you're on. It sounds like casino employees are escorting you and you're limited in what you can see. But still, what's it like? What are you seeing? How's it feel?
Yeah, you're right about that. There's no photographs, no video footage on the tour that I took today. The Encore folks are controlling all of the imagery. They say they will supply images to the press after the fact. So you're right about the tight controls. But what we've been able to see is impressive. I mean, the place looks absolutely spotless. I saw someone actually dusting a fire extinguisher earlier today. I mean, there is no detail overlooked. We spent some time walking through, for example, the chairman's villa, which is sort of the top end hotel room in this resort out of 671 rooms. This thing starts at $15,000 a night, Tiziana.
Jeez.
And that's the midweek rate. It goes up from there on the weekend. So we're talking about some pretty high-end stuff here.
So, okay. So then the $2 billion construction cost is a little less surprising when you tell me something like that.
Right.
And we're starting to get a feel for this, but you've got the eyes in there for us. So how fancy is it? Is this lots of marble and gold?
Yeah, you guessed it. Lots of marble, lots of gold, lots of nice frilly-lined drapes. I mean, everything has a very shiny look to it. What's funny about it, Tiziana, is there are some legitimately really high-end stuff here. They're very proud of their Murano glass chandeliers, for example. Other things just sort of have the look. You know, we went through an Asian restaurant, for example, and were admiring what appeared to be these sort of metal fish sculptures and came to learn that they were actually made of foam. You know, but from a distance, you can't tell. So
yeah,
there's sort of that juxtaposition between the stuff that's genuinely top of the line and the stuff that just sort of has the look. But speaking of the food, you know, there is some really high-end stuff here. And one that really stands out is the lobster roll on the menu at Rare Steakhouse. I'm going to let executive chef Taylor Kearney describe this thing for you.
Black truffle aioli, tons of shaved black truffle zest, gold leaf, beautiful Ocetra caviar. Lobster roll is $68.
That's a little over. Overwhelming, Callum. That's a
$68 lobster roll.
Wow. Did you get to taste it?
No, I did get to taste some Kobe beef, however. This Rare Steakhouse says that it is one of only 9 Kobe beef certified restaurants in the entire United States. And they passed around these little tiny bite-sized skewers of beef. They were delicious. And then informed us after a fact that on your menu, each one of those tiny skewers would be $85.
Good.
So, again, this is gobsmacking stuff in some cases.
Yeah, great word for it, actually. Now, Callum, you've been following this casino and its development from the beginning. Other than sort of the fanciness of it, did you see anything that specifically surprised you today?
You know, one thing that surprised me, Tiziana, was when I first arrived, I came up the elevator from the garage and was walking toward the lobby past some of the retail that they have in here. There's also some shopping to be done. And there is a Wynn-branded menswear store, which I thought was striking because, of course, the Wynn name was really polarizing throughout the whole process here. Remember, it was originally going to be a Wynn-branded casino, and they took the name off and renamed it Encore, right? So it was interesting to me to see where the Wynn name has been removed and where it remains, and apparently they've decided that the Wynn name is still marketable for a menswear store.
That's very interesting. Are they going to be ready for Sunday, Callum? I mean, they're expecting on peak days 50,000 people, so are they ready for the influx?
They look just about ready. There's definitely still some details to be done. For example, when we started walking out for the outdoor portion of our tour, some of us almost tripped over a hose that had been left on the staircase, and our guide was a little bit embarrassed about that and said, you know, we are still getting the final touches in place. But by and large, the place looks ready to roll. And keep in mind that they've had some test runs all of this week with some VIPs and some of their members of Wynn Resorts casinos around the world have been able to come in and test out the games to make sure that everything is going to be running smoothly when the door opens for real on Sunday morning.
They've also tested the equipment to make sure that everything on both sides will be on the up and up as well. Is that correct?
That's right, because obviously one of the things you want to make sure of, especially with the watchful eye of the Mass Gaming Commission, is that everything runs smoothly. And partly because of all of the scrutiny that the commission gave them because of the way that they handled or mishandled those sexual misconduct allegations against the former CEO, Steve Wynn, this is a company that will be up for constant renewal by the Gaming Commission. The commission, remember, for a while considered revoking their license, didn't go that route, but decided that they would keep them with just a very watchful eye throughout, and has emphasized, the commission has emphasized, that this is a constant evaluation that goes on. So you can bet that there will be a lot of monitoring, both from the commission and from Wynn itself, which has every incentive to hold on to this business.
Kellum, that's one of the more, you know, sort of serious subjects associated with the casino. Another is the concern about both gambling addiction, the minimum of 2% of people who are likely to have compulsive gambling problems, and the real accessibility of this casino to people who have the gambling itch. You know, we joked about this at the beginning, at the top of this segment, but gambling addiction can be serious. What kinds of measures are they taking to support people and help prevent addiction?
Yeah, boy, it's serious stuff. I spent some time in Springfield last week, Tiziana, speaking with some folks who were attending a gambling addiction seminar. One gentleman in particular story really stood out to me, and he's someone who has been to prison related to his gambling addiction. He says he has a son who he's never met because of his gambling addiction. So this is really, can be devastating stuff. And so the state is taking it very seriously. And what they've done is they've required in state law that all of these new casinos have what they call Game Sense Advisors within the building. These are not casino employees. These are independent people who know games well. In some cases, they're former casino employees, and they're there to dispense advice and in some cases offer to have people sign up for a voluntary ban list. And so there is one of these little Game Sense corners here at Encore as well, just as there is at Springfield and Plainville. I will say what they have here is a little bit smaller than what they have in Springfield, but it is there as a resource.
So, Kellum, before we go, you mentioned earlier the controversy in the scandal around founder Steve Wynn, the $35 million fine. Are there any other consequences shadowing the casino's opening and operation, or do you expect it to be smooth sailing?
Well, it looks like it'll be smooth sailing on the operations side. You know, what was interesting was, you know, when the commission was first evaluating whether to revoke the license, they said pretty clearly that they didn't think that there was any business trouble with Wynn, that they would be perfectly capable of operating the business. The question was whether the new leadership of the company was fit to continue as a casino operator. And once they decided that, yes, they would, it just seems like it will be smooth sailing from here on out. I mean, there was that tension, of course, Tiziana, about the $35 million fine imposed on Encore, $500,000 on the CEO, Matt Maddox. The company was really not happy about those conditions and also not thrilled about the extra oversight that it's going to get in the coming months and years. But they've decided ultimately to just sort of grin and bear it and try to make a few bucks off of it. And, it looks like they're ready to do that.
All right. Well, watch this space starting Sunday. WBUR Bostonomics reporter Kellum Borchers, thanks.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Stay with us. Coming up, we discuss the Encore opening and more in our Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. I love Friday because I love Week in Review, and it's time. Joining us in the studio this week is Jim Sturgios, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Thanks. Also with us this week is John Carroll, WBUR Senior News Analyst and blogger at It Is Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
All right. So we just heard from WBUR's Kellum Borchers before the break about this big opening of the Encore Boston Harbor Casino. Sunday morning, 10 a.m. They're expecting on big days 50,000 people. What else stood out to either of you from Kellum's report?
Well, they are expecting 50,000 people. They have 2,900 parking spots. So, you know, they're relying on, this is a five-star casino, relying on a third-rate transit system to get most of the people there. It's never a good idea if you have to pack a lunch to go somewhere and gamble. So that's one issue that they're going to have to deal with in a serious way. I mean, think about, you know, getting dressed up and going and waiting for a shuttle at the Orange Line in the middle of the summer.
Although it does sound like they've got some premium options too, both premium watercraft and I think some premium pay shuttle service, as well as the free shuttle.
I don't want to be the skunk at the garden party here, but you know,
they've got
four ships or boats, whatever, and they carry 35 people each. So that's one issue. And the other thing that struck me is there's no entertainment there. again, a five-star casino with no entertainment. And they're saying, well, we're going to rely on local entertainment like the North Shore Music Center. I'm not sure that anybody's going to want to come in to Everett and spend a whole lot of time getting to Fenway Park or getting to TD Garden. So, again, they've got some obstacles to overcome. They've obviously sunk a lot of money into this. They obviously know what they're doing. They have two thriving casinos outside of here. So I think, you know, this is going to be a unique situation for them.
So, Jim, some pretty healthy skepticism from your table mate there. What's your reaction to Callum's report, and how are you thinking about the casino?
I am happy to be the skunk at the party.
You got two skunks in the room today, listeners.
No. I mean, look, these things are all about facades, right? Whenever you go to a casino, something looks fantastic, and what's underneath it may not be as pretty and tidy. In April, there were letters from a number of subcontractors, painters and electricians, who complained that Wynn was not paying them. We're talking about literally hundreds of millions of dollars in non-payment. So this looks like it's ready, but I think there's a lot that's going on. The second thing that I took away from Callum's reporting is this. He talked a lot about oversight, enhanced oversight. And I would just remind everybody, even before some terrible things happened with the company that we learned of in terms of their behaviors, the Mass Gaming Commission did not do an altogether A-plus job in terms of approving this thing. I mean, you're talking about a business relationship between a commissioner and one of the landowners. Lack of adherence to the ethics law. You're talking about business expenses that were wacky. You're talking about hobnobbing with bidders before you even made decisions. So as we're thinking about enhanced oversight from the Mass Gaming Commission, this is a really big test for the Mass Gaming Commission, not just on making sure they pay for the work that's been done by all these great people in the subcontractor trades, but also as they go forward, making sure they behave well.
So, Jim, I want to backtrack. I mispronounced your name at the beginning. Sorry about that. It is Jim Sturgis. And I want to stick with some of the numbers here. So you raised the concern. You know, we talked with Callum about the fact that this was $2.6 billion in construction costs. You've raised a concern that we've heard from other casino developers or about other casino developers in the past about a lot of money invested, but maybe not making it to the workers and to some of the vendors, et cetera. But the casino is supposed to pay 25% of its revenues to the state. And by their projections, that's a $98 million payout, you know, hopefully, in the next fiscal year. And they're talking about 5,800 employees. You both have expressed, I think, some important concerns and skepticism. But, John, is there a chance we're going to look back on this once the opening is over and see it as a good thing for the region?
Well, if my taxes go down, that'd be great. You know, I would like that a lot. And I'm not intending to go out there and gamble to subsidize my tax payments. But I think that if it works out according to projections, that would be good for the state.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, you've got a couple of issues. One is you look at Springfield, which is underperforming. You look at the slots.
Springfield is the latest casino that's been
right,
developed.
Right. That's the MGM casino. You look at Plainville, the slots track, mm-hmm. And basically they're underperforming too. So you have to wonder if that's going to be one of the issues. You know, beyond that, you've also got the idea that it could cannibalize the lottery, and the lottery money goes to cities and towns, and they rely on that. So you know, that could be another issue too. So I don't want to be overly negative about this. I hope it works out. I'm not a big gambling fan. I hope it works out for the people involved, especially the people of Massachusetts. But I think that there are a lot of obstacles here that are going to have to be overcome. They're going to have to be at the top of their game, I think, to really make this work.
Jim, on another sobering subject, we heard Callum talk about a discussion he had earlier this week with people who were discussing their gambling addictions. We've got some tape from the man that he referenced, actually. I want to listen to that real quick.
I'm a happy, grateful, lovable, recovering, compulsive gambler addict. I have a son. His name is Michael. And I've never met him because he was born when I was in prison. And the judge said, you would have bet him in a poker game, so I'm taking him away from you.
So that was Steve, and that story is heartbreaking. Does the location and the availability of gambling for our community concern you, Jim?
Look, I tend to believe that people should do what they want to do, but as a sort of, John said it before, he's not a big fan of gambling. I think the idea that somehow you throw your everything to fortune and hope that it all works out for you is probably a little bit troubling in a society in which you want it to be a meritocracy. You want people to work hard and get things if they work hard, right? So I'm a little troubled. It's not just this. We're talking about online gambling from the Treasurer, Treasurer Goldberg. We're also talking about sports betting and expanding that. It seems that we've kind of crossed a threshold where we kind of just say that gambling is just all in good.
We seem to have gone all in.
Yeah,
on this.
And that's actually a little bit troubling. I do think that, you know, as a society, when we want to think about, you know, teaching your kids about hard work, you want to make sure they think about hard work. I don't want to be, don't want to be a skunk at the party. If people want to gamble a little bit here and there, it's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. But when you get into these situations, I also think that however much the state has said they're putting an effort into dealing with gambling addiction, to me, it feels a little bit like gambling is a fire in the belly, and they're taking out a squirt gun.
Oh, that's a really powerful, powerful image. I want to move on, but actually it's sort of almost like moving back because, John, one of the first things you said when I asked you to your reaction to Callum's segment was you talked about transportation. Traffic congestion, orange line, you know, 35 people per boat when they're expecting 50,000 people on a big day. It's been a challenging couple of weeks for transportation. It's now the second week of delays and hellish commutes following two derailments, most recently a Red Line derailment last Tuesday. The conversation's kind of shifted from general, oh my God, I have to get to work frustration into kind of questioning the system's handling of the crisis, the leadership in the state house. Do you think Beacon Hill and the governor should be blamed for the slow and painstaking turnaround we're trying at the T?
I think there's plenty of blame to go around. Jim's going to have a lot more empirical data than I do. I've just been riding the system for 45 years. And I have to say,
from a very strong anecdotal evidence.
From a writer's standpoint, it really feels like somebody's hobby and they got a little tired of it because it just doesn't work. It doesn't really work. Typical of the T, they're going to raise fares in July. They're going to make maybe $32 million. They're going to lose, you know, about 1.5% of their ridership. There's $42 million in uncollected fares every year. You know, I don't understand why that's not their first alternative as opposed to raising fares on a lot of people who can't afford it.
Jim, you're nodding. Is that the big low-hanging fruit in your mind?
There's so much low-hanging fruit. I think that the issue here is, and let's go right to your question. You said, should the governor and the legislators be blamed for this? And I think the answer is yes.
Okay.
And so the reason I say it is this. We know what the problem is. The T can spend, and here's just two numbers. The T can spend $1.6 billion a year on upgrades and maintenance. That would fix a heck of a lot of stuff. We're only able to spend $900 million this year. We're leaving $700 million
on the table. So you're saying the capacity should be to spend 1.6, but it's actually to spend under a billion.
Yep. And in fact, this is a great progress. In 2014, it was $425 million. So we've made a lot of progress, but we're still not able to crack a billion even, right? And if we're able to spend $1.6 billion a year, we'd actually fix things faster. It'd be a five-year sort of arc. So the reason is this, I believe. There are a number of reasons. No silver bullet here, but one is this. The entire state, with the exception of two authorities, the MBTA and UMass, all their construction can use what they call alternative procurement process. You can just hire a general contractor, have him do it, and he's at risk, for example. Instead, we have this very convoluted, complicated system where we have to pull apart contracts, bid them out, create committees for each of the subcontractor trades, you know.
That sounds grindingly slow.
You create adversarial relationships, you create litigation, you create slowdowns, and it's a mess. The second thing is we do not have the talent within the T's management cadre to do the work. They have people who are just not equipped to do the work. They need to hire better people, and that's an HR system that's broken. And the legislature and the governor, from my perspective, better get on those two issues as fast as they can because people are really ticked off.
Okay. Now, when I was listening to John, I was thinking it does feel like something has shifted because we used to say sometimes the T is frustrating. John, you were saying this thing just doesn't work. And we did speak with Boston City Councilor President Andrea Campbell this week, and she said the same thing. Tipping point happened a long time ago. We've had serious trouble.
that requires not only increased investment in getting this right, but the increased investment is not just to throw money at the problem. It's to make sure that all of the changes we agree need to happen to improve our transit system, that it happens in a timely manner. People cannot wait 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the line. And as taxpaying citizens, we deserve a system that works for us.
So, John, are we in figurative as well as literal gridlock here, where we are stuck and we can't move unless we do some things differently?
With all due respect to Council President Campbell, it is going to be 3 or 4 years before any of these things are done. The Red Line overhaul, the Orange Line overhaul, 2022. They're talking about cutting down on the backlog of repairs and upgrades by 2032. So this is something where it's not going to happen in time. And one of the questions is, you know, do people totally lose patience as opposed to mostly lose patience and, you know, basically go to alternatives? And then we've already got the worst gridlock in the United States of America. Then all of a sudden they say, well, I'm going to drive my car, and that becomes even worse. And then, by the way, it's going to be also harder to get to the Encore Boston Harbor Casino.
Nice tie-in there. I appreciate it.
I try.
Jim, we have been promised change since 2015 and before. Yeah. What is going on?
So we, as when we first went at it as a state, I think we focused on labor reforms. I guess what I'm trying to say to folks is you need to actually redo management. This is no more time to actually focus on labor. This is actually management systems that are broken. Yeah, and I guess, you know, what I was actually taken aback by was the governor said we are making progress at a time where people are actually, you know, experiencing derailments. And I heard from the Secretary of Transportation, the GM of the T, that, you know, it's going to take us a while to kind of figure this out. And I guess this is actually an emergency situation that actually calls for legislation. Until people get their heads around that, I don't think they actually are taking it as seriously as John, who's been riding for 45 years.
So you just called it an emergency situation. Yeah. But here's a quote from Governor Baker, once again sort of saying slow and steady wins the race.
If you spend any time, and I have, wandering around the system and talking to the engineers and the technicians and all the rest, you realize just how old a lot of this stuff is. Investments are going to get made, and I do believe they will dramatically improve the performance of the system.
Okay, I wish our listeners could have seen the look on your face, Jim.
Yeah, they are making progress. The only thing I'd say is, look, this is a situation where people have had it. And to some degree, if you listen to your engineers, what you're going to hear is what they tell you is, oh, this is complicated stuff. And it is. But if you listen to the riders, you kind of say there's no alternative but to make it work. And that means big changes.
Yeah, John, go ahead.
Governor Baker can wander around all he wants. He should ride the system. You know, he lives in Swampscott.
Yeah, he
could take the commuter rail in every
day. I hear this
day.
All the time.
I don't think, Mayor Marty Walsh rides the system much either. Both of them can say whatever they want about it, but going in the right direction. They should be on these trains. They should be on the commuter rail. They should be on the green line. They should be on the red line. And they should experience what other people are experiencing. And maybe then they'd have a little more sense of urgency, and this wouldn't be quite as theoretical a problem.
Yeah, John, to that point, we've had a lot of callers the last couple of weeks, and I want to play a cut from a caller named Ben Ashe, who I think captured the frustration of our riders really well.
I don't take the train anymore because this issue has been going on for many, many years, and it's been going on since I was in college, and that's a long time ago. Now I take my car, and no matter what time of the day, it doesn't matter what time, and I'm stuck in the traffic. This is really a major crisis.
All right, so that's the rider's perspective. We also heard some pretty powerful business perspective this week. This is C.A. Webb of the Kendall Square Association talking about businesses, you know, also having, you know, sort of being full up to the top.
This is not a red line problem. This is a systems failure. We have reached a crisis point. We're in a state of emergency, and we have to act now. The reality is we're competing in a global economy. And guess what? If it's too hard to do business in Massachusetts, they'll go somewhere else.
Reactions to that, either of you?
Just one quick reaction. I spent a lot of time around the state. I spent yesterday quite a bit of time in the Worcester area talking to business leaders. And I won't name their names. However, they said, you know, in some ways, all this gridlock in Boston's a pretty good thing for us because, you know, there are some businesses who want to invest out here instead of being in Boston. Yeah. Because they just can't stand it. So I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I'm just saying the point about mobility of people and the reticence to invest more, I don't think we see it yet, but you will see it. And I think just in terms of recruitment of talent, not a lot of people want to put up with that.
Yeah, John, I want to leave some time for 2020, but one last thought on the T before we move forward.
Well, as Jim says, you know, go west, young businessman. I think that that this claims to be a world-class city, and it's got a third-class transit system. And this, someone said at one point, without the T running efficiently, you know, Boston is Providence. And I think that that's one of the issues that they have to face up to, that, you know, this can't be a world-class city with a transit system running the way this one does.
So let's think about the politics of that for a second. You just said world-class city, third-class transportation system. We've got a governor who is Mr. Fix-It and who is talking about a third term. Is this an albatross around his neck?
Well, I mean, you know, so far he's been Teflon. This could be the Velcro for Governor Baker, that, that, you know, people will, enough people will say, this is it. You know, this is the last straw. If the Democrats can come up with a viable challenger to Governor Baker, I think that that this will be a problem for him.
Well, Jim,
and there are others. There are other issues too. The state police. There are all kinds of issues that haven't really stuck to him. But if somebody came along with and made a good case, they could make them stick.
So, Jim, I heard the word Democrats just come out of John's mouth, and we are in an interesting time for the Democrats. I do want to check in on 2020. Another week, another Joe Biden gaffe. The vice president is still leading in the polls, but in case you missed it, listeners, here's what happened this week. He was at a fundraiser. He described two segregationist senators as examples of colleagues he could work with during an era where at least he says there was some civility in the Senate. And he referred to James O. Eastland and said, he never called me boy. He always called me son. His fellow Democrats, as you can imagine, kind of pounced on this. Senator Cory Booker called on him to apologize. But Biden said to reporters that his critics needed to apologize instead.
Apologize for what?
Cory Booker's called for it.
Cory should apologize. He knows better. There's not a racist bone in my body. I've been involved in civil rights my whole career. Period. Period. Period.
What is he thinking?
He's thinking he's Joe Biden, former vice president who's been in this game for a long time, and he's used to his own gaffes and thinks he can kind of navigate them. I guess, look, on the one side, he does have an incredible record on this issue. On the other side, he is a bit of a dinosaur within the party, given where a lot of the energy of the party is. And I'm not saying I agree with that energy within the party, because I think they're very quick to judge. And I think that ultimately Biden's a very good man. Whatever he was saying there is simply...
Should he be judged on this one? I mean, there is really a difference between a white man calling a white man son and a white man calling a black man boy.
Yeah, that's not for me. That's not my thing. It's I guess what I'd say about him is he's probably not enough of a risk taker to actually... There are going to be some lanes here. Joe Biden's going to have one lane, which is steady, forward, gaffe-prone, but likable. You're going to have the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren lane, and then you're going to have some other lane that might belong to somebody who might be fresh, new, that sort of thing. And they're all going to fit into these lanes. And I think that Joe Biden's pretty comfortable where he is.
So do you think, just one more question to you,
yeah,
Jim, do you think we're going to see people kind of pick those lanes beginning in the debates next week? We've got these two big debates, 10 people per. Are we going to start seeing that shape up?
I do. And I think, look, I think that the rise in Elizabeth Warren's polling, about 4 points, it's not as big as the media would like to make it. I think the media wants to actually get a race going here, make it interesting. But I actually think in the debate scenario, she's going to do very, very well. She's a practice debater. She's quick with zingers. And on a stage like the Trump stage with 10, 16 people, she's a bit like that in terms of quick zingers and getting people undressing them in front of an audience. I think she'll actually do very well and will rise and take that Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren lane.
John, she is surging in the polls just really quickly. Is she going to pull ahead?
I don't know. I want to go back to Joe Biden for a minute, though. I'm sorry, because Joe Biden has a spotty record on civil rights. Joe Biden worked with James O. Eastland on anti-busing legislation. That's a letter that came out yesterday. Joe Biden was part of the 1994 crime bill that increased incarceration among black people. Joe Biden was a really disgraceful in terms of the Anita Hill hearings. I think that he has done good things in the civil rights area, but I think he also has some problems in the civil rights area. So I'm not sure that he should get a pass on this one. And also, his advisors have asked him to come up with a different example of civility and working across the aisle or working with people he doesn't agree with, and he just sticks with this one. I'm not quite sure why that is, but he's not very good at adapting to sort of a changing time.
Okay, so in all fairness, though, to that point, and Jim had said, you know, I said, what is he thinking? And Jim said he's thinking he's been in this game a long time and it's worked pretty well for him. We have a president who arguably part of the reason that his voters love him is he doesn't listen to his advisors, he doesn't adapt, he doesn't apologize. So is Biden just picking up on what seems to have been a winning strategy and running with it?
Okay, so if Donald Trump is a role model for any candidate on the Democratic side, that automatically eliminates them from consideration. I think that that's the prevailing theory, that, you know, Donald Trump can get away with it and Donald Trump doesn't have to apologize. If that's the bar we're going to set for our public officials, you know, we're in a lot more trouble than I thought we were.
Okay, Jim, in a word, what bar would you like to set? Looking at these debates next week, what's something important that you're going to be looking for?
I want to actually understand if there's any kind of crossover appeal that is both populist and sort of steady at the till. I guess one of the things I think everyone has to grapple with is, and it's interesting, if you look at the state level, there are very few populists who are governors. It's not just not a big thing. It's at the federal level that all this stuff is fomenting. People don't trust the federal government on the left, on the right. And it'd be really interesting to see somebody who can actually understand some of that discomfort, but also be steady at the wheel, because I mean, this is something that Trump kind of built his brand on. But certainly there's not a steady hand at that wheel. And I'm not sure within the Democratic Party I see it yet.
All right. Well, we'll be looking for that. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Thanks for being here this week. And John Carroll, a WBUR senior news analyst and a blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two-Daily Town. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, reflecting on the new Showtime drama City on a Hill, which portrays a crime-ridden Boston in the 1990s. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.